and this is in the case of Hornbeck versus Secretary Salazar. Each side has been given 30 minutes. Council have agreed among themselves how you will divide that time up. And we have this very helpful lighting system that will tell you how much time you have left. So we start with Mr. Gray.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Gray, and I'm here on behalf of the Department of the Interior. I've reserved 8 minutes for rebuttal, and would like to thank the court for giving such prompt attention to our motion. Interior concluded that a temporary 6-month suspension of deepwater drilling in the Gulf of Mexico is necessary to ensure that we're not faced with a second oil spill while we're still struggling to contain and clean up the catastrophic spill resulting from the Deepwater Horizon accident. The district court abused its discretion by entering an injunction that prevents Interior from enforcing that 6-month suspension, and this court should stay that injunction for at least 3 reasons. First, the lease suspensions are limited in scope and supported in the record. Second, the district court ignored Congress's substantial delegation of lease suspension authority to Interior, imposed a balancing requirement on Interior that is not required by the statute, and ultimately substituted its judgment for the agency's. Finally, the district court failed to appreciate that for lease suspensions, Congress has already struck the balance in favor of environmental protection, and as a result, the court incorrectly concluded that the equities favor the extraordinary remedy of an injunction.
Mr. Gray, is it still the Secretary's position that the plaintiffs in this case are not harmed by the moratorium?
It is still our position that the plaintiffs have not suffered irreparable harm, at least insofar as their declarations do not support a finding of irreparable harm here.
That's not what I ask you. I ask you whether it's still the Secretary's position that these plaintiffs are not harmed by the moratorium, that they sustain no harm.
I think it's clear from the declarations that they sustain some harm in the form of contract cancellations and different effects. But, you know, for the named plaintiffs here and the declarations that are supporting it, we don't think that rises to the level of irreparable harm.
Well, you don't irreparable harm isn't the standard. As you know, in this circuit, the standard for obtaining a stay for you, for the Secretary, is to show that those parties did not sustain substantial harm by the granting of a stay. And you've just told us that they, in fact, are sustaining harm and will sustain harm.
I think it's the same irreparable harm standard as for the injunction, issuance of
It's really not. I hope you're familiar with the National Treasury employees case from this circuit, which has been briefed. And our standard is not irreparable harm for obtaining a stay. The standards for obtaining a stay are very different from the standards to sustain the Secretary's initial action in the district court, or even from the standards to sustain those actions ultimately on the merits of this appeal. We are here on the motion for stay.
Yes.
If you have acknowledged that these parties will sustain substantial harm by the granting of a stay, then that's the end of the that should be the end of the proceeding. The stay should be denied under the standards of this this circuit.
I disagree. The standard requires a balancing of the harms that the Secretary and Department of the Interior will suffer if the stay is not issued, consideration of the public interest.
Then you haven't read the case that I cited to you, because it requires that all four factors be satisfied in order for you to obtain a stay, and you can't satisfy that third factor.
Well, I think the Hilton v. Broadskill case from the Supreme Court makes it clear that there's a balancing requirement in this case, and the Secretary will suffer irreparable harm if an injunction's not issued.
As Mr. Gray, did you know that in that case, this court also said that the court has not applied these factors in a rigid, mechanical fashion, and that the test is about the balance of the equities. It has been recognized that individual courts are not absolutely bound to treat the four-part test as a mechanistic formula, but rather may weigh each factor in relation to the others and excuse a failure to meet one requirement in light of a particularly strong showing with respect to the others.
That was my understanding of the test. Yes,
to support your position.
I believe that's right, that there has to be a balancing of all the factors here. And not only that, Congress itself has struck a balance in setting up a scheme whereby Interior can issue lease suspensions without itself balancing. Essentially, what Congress said was that when there's a threat of serious or irreparable harm to the environment, that trumps in the short term. Now, balancing requires only for long term if the threat will probably occur.
Mr. Gray, why isn't the government relying more on the property clause and the United States position as the not only the owner but the sovereign of these lands? And it first entrusted that to Congress. Congress entrusted the management to the Department of your department and specifically said that the Secretary, when he finds there is a serious, irreparable, or immediate harm threatened to the environment, he can suspend order suspension of drilling. Why aren't you relying more on the cases that say that the property of the United States is within the discretion? It can be managed by rules. It can be managed by secretaries. As long as they're following the rules that laid out by Congress, it's hard to say that they're arbitrary or capricious.
We've certainly made the point that this is arbitrary and capricious review that the Secretary supplies standards. Now, as far as it says threat of serious or irreparable harm to life, property, or the marine, coastal, or human environment, we've relied mainly on the marine, coastal, or human environment because we think it's clear. Now, certainly the Secretary could rely on the property in this case for the reasons that you've expressed. But the threat here, you know, I think it's beyond question that there's a threat of serious harm to the marine or coastal environment, given the facts.
Public property includes the wildlife and the flora and fauna, everything part of that public land.
Yes.
That's well settled.
Yes, it's well settled. It's well settled that this is federal land and that the Congress has delegated to Interior significant authority to manage that land. You know, in the Gulf Oil case, which we cited, it was clear in that case where after the Santa Barbara oil spill, Interior took a very similar action. And the Ninth Circuit held that an 18-month suspension, when there was no finding that drilling risks would be unacceptable, was within the Secretary's authority. Congress, after that, and legislating against that background, enacted the provision at issue here, making it clear that the Secretary has the authority to issue these kinds of suspensions if necessary. And if you look at the facts...
You're talking about OXLA?
Yes. The 1978 amendments to OXLA added the provision that the Secretary has invoked here. And if you look at the legislative history there, in one of the House reports, I think it's around page 74, 75, the House report, it starts with the Santa Barbara oil spill and says, after the Santa Barbara oil spill, we had to take a new look and new action. That includes the Gulf Oil case and all the litigation around that. And it gives a long history from there until 1977 of all the actions that Congress was taking. So it's clear that Congress was legislating against that background and delegated significant authority to Interior.
Mr. Gray, I'm interested in one of the requirements for you getting a stay, and that is that you've got to demonstrate likelihood of irreparable injury pending appeal if the stay is not granted. Now, you've never applied for emergency relief to us, and I have inferred that that's because there really is no likelihood that drilling will commence during the pendency of this appeal. Now, do you have any information that will lead you to believe that drilling will start pending appeal?
Well, I do know that we've issued the first of the NTLs that have certain requirements and that the certifications are coming back in on that. Absent an injunction, There may be, you know, one other step, but absent a stay of the injunction, I think at that, once those new NTLs are complied with, I think that then drilling could resume. Now, as a legal matter, I don't know. I don't have any idea.
As a factual matter.
I don't think we have anything in this record on as a factual matter whether the owners of the leases, you know, who are the real parties affected, would choose to go ahead with drilling or not. I would say that we have asked for a stay, which is itself sort of emergency relief. We've not asked to expedite, but we've been taking this one step at a time right now.
Let me just ask you this. As I understand it, shutting in a well is a very risky, pricey process. And with the threat of another moratorium, which you've openly put out to the press, is it reasonable to think that an operator would begin drilling with that threat, even if their stay is not in place?
I don't know what the operators will do. It's not in this record. Because it's not in the record, I'm not sure that the court could take notice of what an operator might or might not do in the absence of the stay. The relevant consideration is that in the absence of the stay, there would be no legal impediment to drilling. Now, whether or not they choose to drill or not, that's up to the operators. But I think the court has to be focused on, is there, a legal impediment? And because there would be no legal impediment, Interior could not enforce its suspension decisions if an operator chose to go. And that's where the risk of harm comes into play. And this is a judgment, a predictive judgment about the risk of drilling that's made by the Department of the Interior in the exercise of its expertise.
I understand the risk of drilling, but the likelihood that drilling will commence, I think you have to demonstrate as a practical matter that there is a real threat that it will commence pending appeal.
I think all that the law requires we demonstrate is that there would be no impediment, no legal impediment to drilling at that point.
If we set the precedent that the Secretary's order of suspension can be ignored until there's showing of a likelihood that somebody's really going to drill, seems to me that would be a terrible kink in the law.
And that's why we reserved in our opening brief, if somebody's going to come drill, that we reserve the right to ask for an emergency proceeding.
Well, if you had that right to come in and ask for an emergency stay, why wouldn't that protect you?
Well, I don't think that it would fully protect us. I don't think that we have to sort of be on guard if there's no legal impediment. I mean, Interior's made the decision here that there is a threat, that it needs to impose these new safety measures before there's drilling. And I do want to talk a little bit.
That decision has been enjoined by a district court, and we give deference, as you should, to what that court has done. And again, one of the standards that you have to satisfy to obtain a stay of that injunction is that you will suffer irreparable injury. And as Judge Davis has pointed out, it seems that injury at this point is entirely speculative.
I don't think it is speculative. The Department of the Interior, as I was saying, gets to make is charged with administering this land, and it gets to make predictive judgments about the risk. If you look at the Winter v. NRDC case from the Supreme Court a couple of terms ago, the same sort of situation as we have here, where the Navy wanted to train in particular ways, and a district court said, I'm going to impose certain conditions on your training. And the Navy said, if we have to comply with those conditions, that's likely to undermine our training and cause us irreparable harm in declarations. And the Supreme Court said that a district court has to defer to those predictive judgments. And so, yes, in general, you defer to a district court, but where a district court itself has applied the wrong standard and failed to defer to an agency, that the deference you give to the district court doesn't trump the deference that a district court owes to the agency.
Of course, that's ultimately on an appeal on the merits, and we're here as I keep saying, and you keep seeming to forget, we're here only on the motion for stay. I read in one of the briefs that, and you can correct me if this is wrong, that after this blowout, 29 of the 33 rigs passed inspection. Is that right?
I believe it's 27 of 29 that
All right,
they
27 of 29.
27 of 29 passed the inspection that of the existing inspection requirements. I mean, part of what Interior said in the safety report is that we need new requirements and we need new inspection procedures.
Well,
and so,
but why shut down all of them when you don't really know whether there's any commonality in terms of the cause of the particular blowout and whether other wells share that characteristic? I don't understand.
Well, we do know that there's a commonality of risks for deep water drilling. And there's nothing that requires the agency to take a piecemeal approach here. You know, there's new regulatory requirements. For example, one of the things that they're going to establish through interim rulemaking is a requirement for new well control procedures. When you're saying we're going to have new well control procedures and you haven't even fully defined what they are, it makes sense to take a broad view. They're going to apply industry-wide. There's no way to judge on a case-by-case basis whether you're going to comply with a procedure that hasn't been developed.
And the regulations require you to go in to look at each individual case rather than just simply treating this entire subset of the industry alike.
I don't think the suspension regulation requires that at all. It says the
Section 250.170 says the regional supervisor will set the length of the suspension based on the conditions of the individual case involved. But you haven't looked at the individual case at all. You just
well, I think
the secretary just issued a blanket moratorium.
The individual case here is the circumstance of the we have an oil spill that we haven't stopped yet, haven't shown any ability to contain it so far. Our resources are taxed to the maximum, and in that circumstance, it makes perfect sense to say, just as the Interior did in the Gulf Oil case, that, in fact, we're going to take a timeout here. We're targeting similarly situated rigs that deal in deep water drilling for a short period of time, only 6 months. The threat is fully...
You don't know that they're similarly situated except for your arbitrary limit of 500 feet.
I would disagree that it's an arbitrary limit of 500 feet. What the safety report says is that you look at floating rigs, right? Floating rigs operate in more than 500 feet. They involve more risk than the jackup rigs. That's in the Hayes Declaration as well, paragraph 11. That fully justifies that 500-foot limitation. The plaintiffs really haven't even contested that in their briefing on the stay motion.
I know blowout preventers was one of the suspected causes. Have those do the other rigs, other deepwater rigs, have the same type blowout preventers as a deepwater explorer?
My understanding is they're basically the same, although there may be some variations. I mean, one of the things that one of the components of a blowout preventer, as I've learned, is what's called a blind shear ram, and it's sort of the last line of defense. And what it does is it cuts the drill pipe and seals it. And it's clear that failed in the Deepwater Horizon incident. Nobody's really sure why. One of the regulations that Interior is going to adopt, but it hasn't yet, is to have redundancy for blind shear rams, so that you have to have two spaced at least 4 feet apart. Now, that's a clear, safety equipment that's necessary to prevent a similar kind of harm. It's best practices. I don't know the numbers, but certainly not all rigs use a double blind shear ram system. It was perfectly rational for Interior to conclude that absent that and 21 other new safety measures, it needed to suspend drilling until it could impose those measures. I see my time's up.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Gray. Ms. Wanamaker?
May it please the Court, Catherine Wanamaker for Intervenor Appellants, Defenders of Wildlife Sierra Club, Florida Wildlife Federation, Center for Biological Diversity, and NRDC. I would like to just briefly address two factors that justify granting the stay here, the irreparable harm factor and the public interest. We all know the devastating environmental impacts that have arisen from this spill. The harm is just too great to let this go on without a full safety review. It only takes one more. We know we're at a point where we can't even respond to the spill that we have. 80 days later, it's still spilling.
Of course, the only way you're going to have another blowout is if rigs are out there drilling. And do you have any information about the likelihood of any rigs cranking back up and drilling pending appeal?
We don't have any information other than the government's information. You know, there are a number of amicus parties in this case who have filed briefs suggesting that it's important for them to begin drilling again. That seems to suggest that it could commence, but we don't have any further information about that.
The Center for Biological Diversity takes the position that the government should put, as they put it, put an end to all new offshore drilling. Do you agree with that?
That may be the position they've taken in a certain case. That is not the position.
It's on their website currently. That's the position they take. I just wonder whether that's the position of the interveners generally, whether the best thing to do is just never to have any more drilling, or whether you approve of a resumption of drilling, and if so, under what conditions?
That certainly can't be stated as a position. We represent, you know, five different groups in this case, and so obviously there's a wide variety of opinions on that topic. That wouldn't be our position here. We do feel like it's necessary to have appropriate safety measures and to make sure we fully understand what went wrong at the Deepwater Horizon.
You have no problem with the resumption of drilling after that has been taken care of. Is that right?
As a collective group in this case, you know, it's, I think, fair to represent that that would be our position in this case. Individual parties would have to speak to that separately. One of the other points I just want to briefly touch on is the economic impacts. Obviously, there are major tourism and recreation and fisheries impacts that are very significant to the whole Gulf Coast region. Another spill would obviously put us in further trouble in the tourism industry, in the recreation industry, in the fisheries industry, and those are all major revenue producers as well. So it's important for the court to consider those economic impacts in factoring how the public interest what the public interest favors in this case.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Ms. Wanamaker. All right, Mr. Rosenblum.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Carl Rosenblum. I'm here with, along with my co-counsel, Mr. Cooney, of the Venable Firm in Washington, D.C. His specialty, Your Honors, is in the Administrative Procedure Act and administrative law in general. We'd like to split up our time, 4 minutes for myself to answer some questions and make some opening remarks, 10 minutes for Mr. Cooney to address the Administrative Procedure Act issues, and specifically the first element, Judge Smith, the likelihood of success on the merit, and then I'll come back for the balance of the time to talk about the balance of the equities. And we're here today, as Judge Smith, as you indicated, this is not on the merits of whether or not Judge Feldman was correct granting the preliminary injunction. It's simply on whether the stay should be entered pending that hearing, which would be later in the fall, based upon the court's current briefing schedule. We suggest that the stay needs to be denied because the four factors recognized in the Hilton case, recognized in the Ruiz case, and Judge Dennis, there is in the Ruiz case a recognition that if one of the factors is strongly satisfied, you may be able to satisfy some of the other factors to a lesser degree. But that is not to say that you do not have to satisfy all factors. And we suggest, Judge Smith, that the government has not satisfied any of the four factors. And, Your Honor, you asked Mr. Gray this specific question. If a stay is entered, will the plaintiffs be harmed? And he said yes. And we don't have to show irreparable harm. We would suggest, therefore, when you take that one element, and then you go, Your Honors, to the question of whether what their burden is now. The burdens have switched from when we were in front of the district judge. They've got the burden for them to show that if the stay is not granted, they will be irreparably harmed. They cannot show that. And as a result of that, we would suggest, and I'm going to defer to my colleague, Mr. Cooney, to come back in a minute.
Mr. Rosenblum, let me ask you this. I didn't find these cases in either side's brief, but it seems to me that the Supreme Court has made it very clear that under the property clause, Congress has the sole and exclusive and complete authority to regulate the use of the public's property, and that includes the Outer Continental Shelf. And in a case where the government had given some land to the city of San Francisco on a condition that they could use it, they were misusing the land. And so the government went into court and got an injunction. In other words, the shoe was on the other foot.
Yes, sir.
But in that, I don't see why it should make any difference. And in that case, the court said that the Constitution provides that Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the government's land, and that it is not for the courts to say how that trust shall be administered. That is for Congress to determine. And it went on to say that in a case like this, this case does not call for a balancing of equities or for the invocation of generalities of judicial maxims in order to determine whether an injunction should have issued. The equitable doctrines relied on by the courts do not militate against the capacity of a court, and I think it probably you can read in duty of a court, to take a declared policy of Congress and enforce it. And I don't see any difference where Congress delegates that authority to the Secretary of Interior. He's made rules that enable him, that allow him to suspend drilling and activities whenever he deems that it is a danger to the environment. We've already had one spill. And I think the law is clear in the courts that when you have a situation where irreparable harm is not just threatened but has already occurred once, it doesn't take that much more. If you think there's still a threat out there, it can be enjoined. And I really don't think that the cases you're talking about necessarily apply when the government is enforcing its own rules. It's not on the court. It's also said the government is not only the owner of the property, it is the sovereign, and the Congress can make the rules, and it has made the rules, and the rules are pretty clear. Why doesn't that distinguish this situation?
Judge,
and why are we in a position to second guess the secretary on whether or not there's a threat of irreparable harm if he has found it?
Judge,
and he hasn't been arbitrary. And I know you're going to argue arbitrariness, but I don't think he's been arbitrary in this case.
Judge, I know my time is up, but
yes,
I would
I'm
like
sorry.
To respond to your question if I can. Number one, Your Honor, the Congress has made the rules that the executive branch has not followed. The rules require, and Mr. Cooney's going to address it, a rational relationship between the facts found and the decision made. There is no basis in this administrative record, with all due respect, Your Honor, to the decision to impose this blanket, indiscriminate moratorium. So it is public land, Judge. But the Secretary has not followed the rules. That's the problem. If I can, I know my time is up. I'll finish this way, Judge.
I'm sorry. Maybe we could give you some more time. I apologize.
You want to take some of your co-counsel's time?
Certainly.
Give him 2 minutes. Give him 2 minutes.
I'm sorry, Judge Davis. I didn't hesitate on accepting more time from my co-counsel. But, Judge Dennis, it's very important that you understand. Number one, as Judge Smith indicated, this is simply on the stay issue. And on the stay issue, the government's got the burden on all four of those factors. That's number one. Number two, this really is a case. This is a case about judicial review. The government and it was in the editorial today in the Times-Picayune, the government, by this threat of a second moratorium, and it really goes to what Judge Davis was talking about, has in essence had a de facto moratorium. We want the government to follow the rules. The preamble of OSLA requires a balance. The suggestion that the Santa Barbara case, which is the Gulf Oil case, is the end-all and the be-all, number one, they suspended 11 leases in shallow water, not a blanket moratorium. That's number one, Judge Dennis. Number two, there were amendments right after that case in 1978 that took away from the executive branch what was referred to as the carte blanche authority. So it provided some requirements that prior to those 78 amendments that we have today, the executive branch, in essence, had carte blanche. So when we're talking about this public land, which is what you're concerned about, if I've understood it correctly, Judge Dennis, and I'm going to end with this, that concern, we would suggest they need to follow their own rules. By a stroke of the pen, this moratorium came out. The governor for the state of Louisiana is here and has filed an amicus because they were not even consulted. They were not even consulted. That's what was so upsetting, in my perspective, to what Judge Feldman saw and why he believes that we're going to succeed on the merits down the road. Today, it's simply about a stay. We urge you, and I'm going to come back to address some of the other questions, Judge Dennis, but we urge you to recognize, as Judge Smith has indicated, there are four elements. There's a little fluidity among those elements if you really satisfy one. We suggest they do not satisfy any of them.
Okay, let's hear from Mr. Cooney.
Thank you, Joe.
May it please the Court, John Cooney for the plaintiffs in this case. I'm going to address the first factor in the probability of success on the merits criterion for obtaining a stay. The first factor is that the applicant must make a strong showing that it's likely to succeed on the merits of its case.
But let me just ask you a couple of questions about that. Given the catastrophic accident that we had here, do you disagree that some suspension of operations of deepwater drilling was justified?
Your Honor, one of our points in this case has been that the moratorium itself is not justified. The district court found,
is some suspension of all operations justified?
That the secretary, if he could make the proper findings, could justify some kind of interim delay.
All right, let's say he said that we've had a horrible accident out here, and we don't know what caused it, and we need to investigate it and put in and implement some new safety measures. Does that justify any suspension of operation?
The answer to all these questions will be, depending upon the record, it may. The problem here is in the record.
You've got an administrative record.
And the administrative record here, as the district court found, shows this. There was no rational connection between the conclusion the secretary reached, the moratorium, and the facts that were in the record.
I'm asking you a little narrower question than that. I'm asking you whether any suspension of operations could be justified on this administrative record.
Oh, let me try to answer the question this way. The safety measures report that's the soul of the moratorium here did envision that there would be short-term delays in resumption of operations for 30-some safety recommendations that had been identified by the experts. And what it was envisioned there is that there would be a period in which the drillers would have the opportunity to implement the safety recommendations, and as they implemented those safety recommendations, presumably they'd come back online. They'd apply to the department, show that they'd satisfy the criteria. When they'd satisfied the notice to lessees, they'd be permitted to resume operations. The difficulty here is that the moratorium is a one-size-fits-all device that keeps everybody out of the market, regardless of whether
You're not answering my question. I'm asking you whether, based on what happened offshore here with this Deepwater Horizon rig and the catastrophic result that has occurred because of that, based on the administrative record, the safety report particularly, did that justify any suspension of operations? Now, that's not a hard question.
The answer is Judge Feldman found that it might, if that
I'm
is what the Secretary
what Judge
did.
Feldman found. I'm asking you what the position is of the plaintiffs.
The position of the plaintiffs is the only issue before the court today is a moratorium, and the moratorium is not justified.
I'm entitled to ask you a question that's narrower than the one before the court.
That's true.
And I want an answer to it.
The answer is there may be a justification for targeted interim suspensions. That is what the department has proposed.
Is there justification to shut down all operations for any length of time, a week, 2 weeks, any length of time?
Yes, Your Honor, if there are factors that are common to all of them that would justify an invocation of a common rule.
All right, we don't know what caused the accident, so we need to investigate it. Is that not common to all of the rigs?
We have a substantial amount of information about what caused the accident. We did an immediate post-analysis inspection of all the rigs. 27 of the 29 rigs passed all requirements in the government standards. Two had minor difficulties.
We may have substantial information, but the Secretary made the judgment that he didn't know what all the causes of the accident were.
Well, the Secretary, in fact, did not make that judgment based on a record. There was no rational connection between what the Secretary found and what was in the record before him. The record before him was a safety measures report, which was drafted by a team of experts who were looking to and recommended to the Secretary interim provisions that could be implemented quickly, most within 30 days, that would enhance safety in the Gulf. And they also recognized that there were other things that could be considered over time and might be implemented through an emergency.
You're not willing to answer my question whether the administrative record justifies any suspension of operations, a day, an hour, a week.
I've been trying to say that the safety measure report, in fact, identified 33 or 34 recommendations like that, most of which were short-term. The answer is yes, these were the ones that were justified by the record. What was not justified by the record is a moratorium.
How long is a suspension of operations, in your view, justified?
The answer is when the department puts out a criterion until the regulated entity satisfies the criterion. As the regulated entity satisfies the criterion, it should be able to resume operations. The problem with the moratorium, which I'm trying to distinguish, is it's a one-size-fits-all mechanism. The industry leader is treated the same way as the industry laggard. They are all frozen in the limbo for an extended period of time. There is no way that any one operator can come into compliance with the safety measures that are put out by the government and then resume operations. So the answer is, yes, there are things that were recommended in the safety measures reports that seem to make good sense to the scientists and that were recommended to the Secretary.
Do you agree that the BP oil spill has given light to a heretofore unrecognized weakness in the ability of the, I know you're not representing drillers, ability of drillers at 5,000 feet to handle a blowout? Don't you think there's enough doubt there's a rational connection between that and stopping for a while to figure, to make sure that the other people drilling at those depths BP may be the only one, but we don't know that yet.
There's no support for that conclusion in the record, Your Honor. What there is an identification that 29 rigs that were tested passed on that. There are findings from the scientific experts and affidavits in this court to say that the risk of the occurrence of a blowout is very low, has been consistent over the years. There's nothing about the overall risk factor that has changed. The department has studied the risk of a blowout for 40 years or more, and they understand it reasonably well. When the expert scientists studied this matter,
includes both the likelihood and the magnitude of the harm.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Did we really appreciate the magnitude of harm until we see our whole Gulf of Mexico filled with oil?
The magnitude of the harm is great in these cases, and there have been a total of four blowouts like this in the world since 1969. The safety record is good, but when they do occur, they have horrific consequences on human life, unfortunately, as it did here, and on the environment. But the scientists who studied this did not find a systemic flaw in the technologies involved here. There is no finding, for example, in the administrative record that all blowout preventers currently on the market don't work.
Now, let me ask you this. My understanding is the Deepwater Horizon had an excellent safety record. Is that your understanding?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, but I've read that anecdotally in the press, that it had passed the government requirements.
And would that not support thinking by the Secretary that whether a rig passes a safety inspection is not a good predictor of whether they're going to have a a catastrophic blowout?
Well, it's a fact that certainly has to be taken into account. It's not irrelevant. It's not the total answer to the question.
I know it's not the total answer, but it is a fact that would support that conclusion, is it not?
And that is why the Secretary decided he needed to have the inspections conducted, and he also had to have the scientists study the matter. The scientists who studied the matter did not recommend a total cessation.
Well, maybe some of them did.
Drilling.
Some of them certainly did they not?
They weren't consulted on the moratorium, were they?
No, they were not consulted on the moratorium
because I haven't read where they made any recommendations.
It was inserted into the document after they had cleared it and after they approved the recommendation.
They just said we don't agree with the moratorium.
They did say that in part, but the important thing to understand is that the moratorium was inserted late after their review had occurred. There are no facts in the documents to support the moratorium. The facts in there supported a series, to come back to Judge Davis's question, a series of rational things that could be done and could increase safety in the short term, most of them to be implemented within 30 days, after which individual rigs would get back into operation as appropriate as they came into compliance.
You agree that it's the responsibility delegated to the Secretary to determine whether there is an unacceptable risk of another blowout.
That is delegated by Congress, provided that the Secretary operates under appropriate procedures and makes appropriate findings that are supported by the administrative record. Our disagreement is on the adequacy of the findings. Excuse me, I interrupted.
That's all right. What level of risk of another blowout is acceptable, do you say?
That question is for the Secretary to determine. It's not for the courts to determine. The problem is it has to be done under proper procedures and with proper findings. And
what level do you say is acceptable?
Your Honor, I cannot make that judgment. I am not the expert. That is for the Secretary to make. A layman is not in a position to make that.
You say the Secretary didn't properly evaluate the risk, so you must have some standard you're judging him by.
I do not have a standard. I have a process objection, Your Honor. There was nothing in the moratorium, in the safety report as written, to support a moratorium. That was added late in the process. The report was not rewritten to provide a rational basis for that conclusion, which has the effect of keeping everybody off the market, regardless of whether they have the most feasible, the most state-of-the-art emergency prevention equipment on the market in the world today.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cooney. Mr. Rosenblum, back to you.
Your Honor, let me follow up on some of your questions,
because
that's why we're here, to answer the court's questions. I have my prepared remarks, but I want to answer the court's questions. We're dancing around the issue of the threat of a second spill and being able to address it. That's what we're – I mean, I believe every question is really that concern, and the plaintiffs do not take that lightly. The issue, though, on this stay issue, Judge Smith, is whether those four elements are satisfied. And when you look at that concern of a second spill, number one, the law on a stay issue it's not satisfied by a hypothetical threat, number one. Number two, it was considered by Judge Feldman and Judge Smith in your earlier case in dissent. You indicated that there should be a presumption of correctness given to the district judge at this level. And we suggest that that's exactly what you have. Now, we're talking about a low risk of this second spill, although it's not zero, but there's always a risk.
But what's an acceptable level of risk?
What's an acceptable level of risk? Judge Davis, what we would suggest when you balance whatever that little bit of risk or greater risk is against the actual harm that is being inflicted by this moratorium that's been enjoined, but the de facto moratorium with the threat of a second moratorium coming any day now, when you balance that threat, however small or even beyond a little bit more small, Judge Davis, against the actual harm that's being imposed. The amicus, and Mr. Dart's going to refer to it in detail, people are being put out of jobs, out of work. The rigs are leaving the Gulf. They're going to foreign waters. All of this being done inconsistent with what Oxler requires and what the Administrative Procedure Act requires. And that's why, Judge Smith, those elements for the narrow issue, although it's critical, for the narrow issue before you today, which is on the stay, pending the merits, we're going to come back someday, probably in the fall.
Well, likelihood of success on the merits is one of those elements.
For the stay?
Yes.
Absolutely.
I thought that's what we were talking about.
Well, what we're suggesting, Judge Davis, if I haven't made myself clear, is when you look at the State Farm case, which is the seminal case under the Administrative Procedure Act, there has to be a rational connection. And we would cite you to Volpe as well. There needs to be a rational connection between the facts found, which is the safety report. Everything comes back to that safety report and the decision that was made. The decision that was made was a blanket moratorium. Those are the two pieces that have to connect. There is no connection. So on that first factor, Judge Davis, for the stay issue, we suggest they can't succeed on that one factor. But even if they can under the fluid test under Ruiz that this Court has announced, even if they can, they cannot satisfy any of the other three factors, because Judge Smith asked Mr. Gray the question, will this stay harm the plaintiffs? He said yes. That's the second factor. They can't satisfy that. That's a black and white test. The third.
Well, some cases say that you can use a balance of the probable harm.
Absolutely, Judge Davis. I think that's actually the third factor. Does the balance of the harm of not giving the stay outweigh the harm of giving the stay? And we would suggest that you've got a threat of a second spill, but you don't. And you balance that against the actual harm that we're talking about, that tens of thousands of people are being put out of work. And we're talking about 3 or 4 or 5 months until we get here on the merits of the appeal.
No, you're not either. We're going to expedite this appeal.
Wonderful.
You'll have an argument probably the week of August the 30th.
Wonderful, Judge Davis. We're ready to do that. Then let me suggest this. Then what we're talking about is a stay for that even shorter period of time. It shouldn't be instituted. The companies that are in the Gulf, the entire network that my clients are involved in, should have some guidance from this Court in the interim of what they can do, because otherwise they're going to leave. And, in fact, they're already leaving and entering into longer-term contracts in Brazil, West Africa. We would cite this Court to the CSX case. And in the CSX case, there was an ordinance in Washington, D.C., that the D.C. Circuit recognized that enjoining the railroad from carrying the hazardous substances was improper because it was not irreparable when you looked at the interconnected railroad system. Here we have, with the stroke of a pen, shutting down for all practical purposes the deep water drilling industry. We're not just talking about Judge Smith or Judge Dennis or Judge Davis. We're not just talking about 29 different rigs. We're talking about the soup to nuts of what supports all of these. That's why we have so many amicus here. They're coming from every aspect. You've got the IPAA on behalf of the producers. You've got the IADC on behalf of the drillers. You've got the state of Louisiana. You've got the various chambers of commerce. Soup to nuts of what's happening, and all of that was done, Judge Dennis, without following the rules. That's really fundamentally what this case is about. All the plaintiffs want is to have the government follow the rules.
Basically, you're saying the Secretary had no significant facts to base the moratorium on.
That is absolutely correct, Judge Davis.
Let me just ask you about a couple of things. I mean, don't you think the catastrophic nature of the blowout and not knowing precisely what caused it is one fact they could rely on?
Yes, it's a factor. But it is not a substantial factor, with all respect, Judge Davis, nor is it a prevailing factor, because when you look at the four factors for a stay, under the Hilton case, the Supreme Court's Hilton case, we can't go back.
Well, let me ask you about another one. Would the fact that maybe all the other deepwater rigs were working under the same regulations and with similar equipment as the Deepwater Horizon, is that not a fact the Secretary could rely on?
It is. In fact, he did exactly the right thing initially, Judge Davis, by bringing in the experts to do a safety analysis, which is what they did, by sending out the MMS inspectors at the time to look at all the rigs that were drilling. He didn't shut it down. In fact, there's no support to shut it down. In fact, the safety experts suggest that this moratorium that they were not consulted about may be more harmful to long-term safety then the short-term safety implements that they set forth in that safety report. When you look at the safety report, when you look at the post-incident inspection report, Judge Davis, when you look at that, there's just no support for this moratorium. That's what Judge Feldman was concerned about. And then when you get to the four factors, when you get to the four factors for this stay, and Judge Davis, if we come back within 6 weeks or whatever the timing was that you suggested, within 2 months, that's wonderful. We'll talk about whether Judge Feldman was correct on the merits. I look forward to that. But for right now, the drilling industry and the entire network, NPR called it the ecosystem of the businesses in the Gulf, they need some guidance to know that they can go ahead and invest and commence drilling under the safe regulations to be able to start making investments, Judge Davis, and then to have the executive branch with a stroke of the pen take it out and not follow the rules. That's what we're talking about. That should not be permitted. That's why Judge Feldman suggested he thought we had a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. He found that we were substantially threatened with irreparable injury. And he went through those four elements. When we had the burden, here the government's got the burden, and we suggest they have not satisfied that burden for a stay. Who better, Judge Davis, than those experts, the government's own experts, to see what should be done to address this horrific problem? All right? Judge Davis, we can't go back. We can't.
Well, you know, we have to follow the law. The law says that the Secretary of Interior is the one that has to make that decision.
If he has a rational basis for making it, if it's been investigated.
We would have to ultimately say that he was irrational. And that's a pretty big step in view of what's happened and the effects of it.
Judge Dennis.
And he may have been overcautious, in your opinion, or maybe even in mine. You know, maybe I would have said stop drilling below 1,000 feet or let people drill until they get to a definite, predictable danger level. I mean, I can sit here and second-guess the Secretary all day long, but I can't do that. I'm bound to uphold the law, and the law says that he is entitled to a lot of deference. He's got experts working for him, too. And he's vested with the authority to make this judgment about whether it's so dangerous to the environment to the extent that new regulations, new ROVs, new BOPs, new something or other. That's the frightening part about this. We sat and watched on television and saw.
I watch it every day.
The BP failed over and over again to stop that, and it's still going.
Let me respond this way, Judge.
Yes. Davis.
Number one, the investigation of what caused that spill is still ongoing. But what we do know, and the Secretary has said it himself, that there is a substantial amount of human error. There's a substantial amount of human error in there, right? We're not suggesting.
I hope so.
Well,
we can find one bad apple. But we may not be able to.
Judge Dennis, what I'm trying to get out, and I'm not sure I'm doing it, but let me try again, is the goal of safety is not mutually exclusive with this moratorium. It's not. And your comment about the Secretary's experts, that's the safety people. That was the Secretary's experts. He rightly went to those experts, Judge Dennis, and those experts instituted and recommended a number of short-term immediate safety measures. They recommended a number of emergency rulemaking measures and then some normal rulemaking measures. That's fine. Plaintiffs can live with that. That was consistent with what he should have done and what the law requires. But what he didn't have the right to do, we suggest, with a stroke of the pen on May 28th of this year, cutting the legs out from this entire industry. That's the problem. Now, we're going to get there on the merits in a month or in a half, whenever we get there, Judge. That's the problem. The suggestion that the Secretary's got the authority to do that with a stroke of the pen With
now, what are we to though? Before he stroked his pen.
Excuse me, sir.
You don't know how long he thought about it before he stroked his
pen.
It wasn't too long.
It wasn't too long, Judge Dennis. In fact, it probably was not much longer than when they came out with the threat of a second moratorium when Judge Feldman entered this injunction.
Well, yeah. That was going to be my next question. Anyway, what in your client's view, what should we make of the fact that apparently the Secretary has said that if this stay is denied, he will just enter another a moratorium of some kind?
Your Honors, I would suggest you go back to 1803 and Marbury versus Madison. That case recognized that the judicial branch needs to review whether or not the executive branch follows the law. The Secretary of the Interior, with all the utmost respect, and the government has not followed their own rules and regulations. So, Judge Smith, the suggestion of a second moratorium is really an attempt, with all respect, Your Honor, to intimidate this court. To suggest, well, if you deny the stay, we're going to come out with a second moratorium. What we suggest, if you look at the checks and balances that are fundamental to our constitutional system, you look at Marbury versus Madison, to disregard following this appeal is fine. Seeking a stay is fine. To come out with this overarching threat, we suggest, is an affront to the standards of judicial review. We urge you to look at the briefs, to look at the law, and to deny the request for a stay. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Dart.
Yes, may it please the court, Henry Dart, amicus for the state of Louisiana, and our governor, Bobby Jindal, who's here in the courtroom today. Appellants summarily argue that the public interest demands a stay to protect jobs, economic resources, and coastal ecosystems for all the public. Whose jobs and economic resources are they talking about? Whose coastal ecosystems do they think are being affected? The amicus briefs in support of appellees do an excellent job of answering the first question, and time does not permit a more detailed answer here. But in the last 5 years, Louisiana has been wounded three times. First, by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005. Second, by the worst economic recession since the Great Depression of the 30s. And finally, now, by the Deepwater Horizon disaster. This trifecta of catastrophes have left Louisiana hanging on by an economic thread. A drilling moratorium would be the coup de grace. While the argument that the moratorium affects only a small part of the offshore oil industry might have some appeal in the context of a healthy economy, even a partial shutdown promises to send our state into a tailspin.
What would another blowout do to the state?
I don't know that it could make it worse, Your Honor. We are inundated with oil. The interveners have talked about our seafood industry being in jeopardy. Our seafood industry is dead. Our hospitality industry is on the ropes. I don't know how much worse it could be. And to answer your question, Judge Davis, earlier, the speculative risk of another oil spill loses significance given the bleak environmental reality that we are now finding ourselves in, especially when balanced against the certainty of severe economic hardship a moratorium would cause. To answer Judge Dennis's question, as it concerns the public interest, OXLA mandates federal cooperation with the state of Louisiana. Here, the government did not meet its statutory obligation to consult with the state under Section 1334A.
You have a red light, Mr. Dart.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. Gray, back to you.
Thank you. I have several points on rebuttal. I'd like to start with the merits, if I can. Counsel conceded that this decision is within the Secretary's judgment, and he conceded that at least some suspension would be necessary. So the disagreement appears to be with 6 months, and I want to explain why that's justified in the record. First, the recommendations were in three categories: immediate interim final rulemaking, and notice and comment rulemaking. In particular, if you look at page 23 of the safety report, it says interim final rulemaking for new requirements for well-controlled procedures within 120 days. That's 4 of your months right there. It's going to take at least a couple more.
Why does it take that long, Mr. Gray?
Well, the procedures aren't well-defined yet. The Interior has to study them, define them, write the regulations, make sure the regulations are written correctly legally, and you know, then promulgate the regulations.
Any
it just takes time for an agency to...
Any prescribed time limits or time that it needs to... Do you have to have a public hearing, or what do you have,
well,
do you have to do?
Well, for the full notice and comment rulemakings, you would have to open it for public comment, yes. Under the emergency rulemaking authority, which the interim final rule will be, I don't think it has those same sort of requirements, but they put this 120-day deadline on that, which is really fast for an agency to move with and write and promulgate a new regulation. In addition to that 120 days, as we noted in our brief, Interior has set up strike teams that are supposed to meet and report back within 6 months. I think the combination of those two things fully support the six-month duration of the suspensions here.
Why couldn't limited drilling be begun or during part of this six-month?
Again, because there's no requirement in the statute that or in the regulations that you go piecemeal or allow this or that. The Secretary made a decision that these requirements are necessary. And until those requirements are put in place, that deep water drilling, and remember, this only applies to deep water drilling. There can still be drilling in shallow water, and it doesn't affect any production well. So the Secretary decided that it was limited based on those facts. I think because of the property clause that you were mentioning, Judge Dennis, that the Oakland Cannabis Buyers case and the TVA v. Hill case have a special relevance here in when the court is exercising its equitable judgment in balancing the equities and considering the public interest, because Congress clearly expressed a judgment here in favor of short-term environmental protection with the cancellation. And it's not the court's duty to second-guess Congress's judgment, especially in an area where it's legislating under the property clause. As far as the harm
well,
to the...
Before you, Secretary, issues another moratorium, I, as a citizen here, would like to see some reasons why it takes that long and why we couldn't bring drilling back into at least a 1,000-foot level or I don't know why geologists couldn't predict when you're getting close to a reservoir or sand or whatever it is and stop drilling at that point. Why do we have to suffer for 6 months? I would rather, instead of issuing another moratorium, I'd like to see him issue some reasons.
Well, I think that the reasons are expressed, as I was saying. You know, he identified, and they make this deal. They make a big deal about the experts.
I read my law clerks, and I read the record, and I'm satisfied that he did not act arbitrarily or irrationally. But he sure could give a lot more reasons
for not allowing any
drilling and taking 6 months.
That's right. And I think that, in this, what goes to your point is what the Supreme Court has said on numerous occasions, most recently in the SEC v. Fox case, which is that even a decision of less than ideal clarity should be upheld if the path can be reasonably discerned. And I think certainly here the agency's path can be reasonably discerned. Even if, he might have done a better job or the Interior might have done a better job explaining, certainly, the path is there, the situation is there. He said under current conditions, of course, that includes the spill, the inability to stop it. I think that's fully justified on the record.
Does the record show that the Secretary considered the
severe economic harm that befalls the oil industry and the workers in the oil industry as a result of the six-month moratorium?
I don't believe there's anything in the record about that, and it's not required under the statute. The district court did say that, you know, the secretary should have weighed these things. It's just not required under the suspension authority. It is required to cancel leases, but Congress made a deliberate choice with the suspension authority to say you can suspend if there's a threat, right? That's all you need. It's not even a probable cause. Just if there's a threat, you can suspend right then, and you don't have to. I mean, if you look at the legislative history, it says for cancellations, we want a balancing, and we expect that for suspensions, that Interior will take immediate action.
But that, so, now the consideration that Judge Davis asked you about is certainly one of the factors, the public interest factor, that we consider in terms of whether to grant a stay. Isn't that right?
I think it can be considered, except that, as I was saying...
It's one of the factors. One of the four factors. I know you want to overlook two or three of the factors. I understand that. But you're the one that moved for a stay, and you have to abide by the standard. Should we ignore the public interest as we decide whether to enter a stay that you have requested?
You should not ignore the public interest. But what you have to do under the Oakland Cannabis Fires case is you have to look at Congress's judgment expressed in the statute and how Congress ordered the priorities. Here, Congress ordered the priorities in favor of environmental protection in the short term, and it's not the court's role to second-guess that congressional judgment, especially where it's legislating in a property clause context.
Well, you're back to arguing the ultimate merits of the appeal.
No, I'm arguing on the public interest factor.
Yeah.
Question
I ask of opposing counsel, what should we make of what I understand to be the Secretary's indication that if this stay is denied, that he will issue another order or another moratorium? Tell us what we can anticipate in that regard.
The Secretary is looking at a new decision based on new information. It is not tied to this court's decision.
It's not at all tied to this court's decision. All right.
That's my understanding, is that the Secretary is in the process. We're not in a position to say when the Secretary will act, but he's gathering all the information and working with the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management.
So whether we enter the stay or not is irrelevant, you're telling us, to whether the Secretary is going to issue another order.
I believe that's right. The Secretary has said he's going to issue another order. It's not dependent on what this court does. I see my time is up.
It's okay. I mean, is there any anticipated schedule for the issuance of that moratorium?
I do not have a schedule. What I've been told is that, you know, we're just not in a position to say, but that they're working diligently.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
All right, counsel, thank you very much for your briefs and your argument, and we have it, and we hope we'll get a decision out by early next week at the latest. Thank you very much. We stand in recess.